Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner. There's a very special performance happening right now in Baltimore at Center Stage. It's called The Raisin Cycle. It plays through June the 16th and is a doubleheader that includes Clybourne Park, a Tony Award-winning play that also won the Pulitzer Prize. That's an answer and a continuation to Lorraine Hansberry's Raisin in the Sun. And Beneatha's Place, written by Kwame Kwayarma, which follows the character Beneatha from Lorraine Hansberry's A Raisin in the Sun, that explores the power of identity and more. As I said, both plays pick up where Raisin in the Sun left off and raise and wrestle with questions of race and class in our own communities. Joining us now is Kwame Kwayarma, Center Stage's artistic director and the playwright who wrote Beneatha's Place. And Kwame, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Thank you, Mark. Great to be on, as always.
This play that you wrote, Beneatha's Place, let me just start there. Mm-hmm. I watched you a little bit go through the painstaking process of creating this play. And you, this is difficult to have done what you did, I think. You took the answer to a play based in Chicago and took it to Nigeria.
Yes.
Now, most people go, why would you do that? It's about America.
Well, a couple of things, Mark. I mean, I saw Clybourne Park in London. I saw it in Los Angeles. And I thought, as brilliant as the play is and was, that there was a few connotations that I had issues with. And one of them was the fundamental, and I don't think that Bruce meant to do this, but was the fundamental assertion that white flight equals black blight. We meet the first act and the antagonist is saying, if you let the blacks into the neighborhood, which would be the youngest from Raisin in the Sun, if you let them into the neighborhood, it will be destroyed. And then we meet the play in the second half with the neighborhood destroyed.
Right.
And a young white family coming in to regentrify and to make it good again. And there's a connotation, not that I think that Bruce was doing, but meant to do, but there's a connotation that blacks build, that whites build and blacks destroy. And so I kind of wanted to look at if all plays, both Raisin and Clybourne, was about ownership and about neighborhoods and territory. Well, I kind of wanted to look at the original invasion, quote unquote, which might be colonialism, and look at the cost of that on not just neighborhoods, but countries and whole continents. And so that's really why it was set in Nigeria, because Beneatha says at the end of Raisin in the Sun, she says to her mother, Asagai, her suitor in the play, is has asked me to come to Africa with him. And I thought, well, then that's what Beneatha does. Let's imagine a world where Beneatha takes him up on that offer, and goes to Nigeria. And so we landed in 1959 Nigeria, where Asagai is a member of a freedom, of one of the independent parties seeking for full independence from the British. So that's its genealogy.
And it does. I found it interesting that again, that in your response to this, there's so many levels to this, but in the play Clybourne Park, the person who is the consistent is Carl Lindner, the only
yes.
white character in Raisin the Sun,
yes.
who came to Younger's apartment to say from the Clybourne Park Improvement Association, we don't want you moving here, let me help you out of this contract. But in your play, you took Joseph Asagai and Beneatha and built it
yes.
around them. But you also made a decision to keep most of the characters white, even in the place of academia and the Black Studies program, even in their meeting in Nigeria?
Well, first of all, there were a couple of producerial challenges. And the first was that if I were, Center Stage then, particularly, we did a six-play season in our main houses. And this would be a seventh play. And economically, it meant that what I was trying to get by putting these two plays in rep was two for the price of one. So hence we kept the same director, we kept the same cast, we kept fundamentally the same set. But what it meant was that as a writing exercise, I had to use Bruce's character, so that we could have the same cast footprint. And I don't mean characters as in who they are, but I mean in terms of their racial breakdown, in terms of their age, those kind of demographics I had to follow. Otherwise, producerially, the project wouldn't work. It would cost us double and we couldn't produce it. So, and some writers would find that limiting. And sometimes it was slightly frustrating. But actually, what it meant was I could craft a story based around Beneatha and Asagai where the majority of the characters are white, come into this world. That was in the first half. In the second half, when we're in talking about African-American studies versus white privilege studies or critical white studies, I did a lot of research, and I found that many professors in African-American studies in universities around the country were Caucasian. And so I found interesting, and I found amusing and ironic and progressive and all, you know, wonderful things. And so it wasn't hard to create an environment where they were discussing this. And the major lecturer in African-American history was someone who was Caucasian.
What I found interesting was watching this progression between these three plays. Before I saw Clybourne Park, I reread Raising the Sun, and then I read Clybourne Park. And then your office was so kind to send me a copy of Beneath This Place, which I was able to read over the weekend again after seeing the play. And the conversation about race and class runs through these three in very different ways. I mean, you know, Raising the Sun, classic 1959 debates within the black world over the bourgeoisie versus working class, the nationalism versus integration and civil rights, wanting to get ahead and be part of the system. You have also transformed that into kind of responding to Clybourne Park, which is kind of what white people were going through more than anything else.
Yeah.
To the contradiction.
And what white males in particular were going through.
Yes, white males in particular. To you kind of addressing the complexities of race that we don't want to talk about, that we can't get to, that aren't easy to fathom or even speak about.
I think the objective I set myself was, as a new person to America, was to kind of take the temperature of race as I perceived it today. I often discuss myself as never having written about race before. All of my plays are set in the black community, and the byproduct of racism, the byproduct of dehumanization, the byproduct of all of those things. But I've never hit it bang on the nose before, because I've never thought that I needed to do that. But I felt, when I saw Clybourne Park, I felt a desire to answer to some of the underlying things that, when I read the criticisms of the play, that I did not see covered, about why does black blight, why does white blight have to equal black blight? Why are there jokes in the play that, when offensive to women, are actually about class, but when offensive to the African-American community, are about intelligence? And so I found those things to be fascinating, and a fascinating area by which to investigate. Not have any answers, but to investigate. So I think I entered into the foray trying to ask the question of, where is race in America today as I see it, from my narrow lens? And I see it. I see plays like Clybourne, I just have to keep on saying, which I think is a brilliant play, but at its essence, is saying we, in particular, middle-aged white men, are fed up of having to live within the strictures of political correctness. We're no longer racist like our forebears. We're trying our best, but we just have to live within this narrow bandwidth, and I need to rebuke political correctness. And in both halves of the play, that's its fundamental theme. And I kind of went, well, now I'd like to see it through the lens of an African-American woman. And I'd like to see about where race is now in terms of ownership. Who has ownership on the race card? Who has ownership on the race debate? And I think one of my arguments is, or one of my questions is the race card, does the race card now belong to the white community?
Exactly. I mean, the fact that the Beneath's character in your play, and we won't give it all away here so folks can see it, but that she understands how to manipulate all that. She's been through so much, seen it from both sides of the ocean, seen it from the African perspective, and from the colonialism, from being colonized to the fight against slavery segregation in America, and being in the midst of the white-dominated educational hierarchy and power structure.
Absolutely.
She brings all that to this.
When I was trying to create an arc for the story, it was, what did Benita learn from her time in Africa? Her time of having to negotiate with the British around independence, of having to negotiate with her American neighbors, how having to negotiate with complicity for colonialism as well from some of the African parties around her. What lessons did she learn? What did she bring back to America? And what did she bring back to the world today? How does she serve today? And those are the questions that I was trying to ask, or trying at least to push us towards, because she learned a lot. And in learning a lot, she learned how to negotiate and deal with the white power structure that rules the Western world.
But you also, you didn't shy away from, between your characters, forcing them to wrestle with the complexities of race and class, turning it on its head a little bit.
Well, yes. I mean, I have, and I put my caveats of only hats on, of only being here for 2 years. But I think often, that what happens, what I have observed in America, is that sometimes questions around race are really about questions about class, and the two are conflated. And I wanted to just investigate that. For instance, I know, having a Caribbean and African background, having judges of 5 generations or having entrepreneurs of 20 generations, it's nothing to talk about. Or, it's not something that you would celebrate during Black History Month. Complicity with the establishment is common for this, we know. So I think I wanted to look at, one of the characters is the son of a billionaire, and he's Black, and he carries with him much of the guilt of exploiting his country or his family and his ancestry, exploiting the poor, exploiting the country, and having privileges that are almost invisible to the naked eye without even thinking about it. So it was important to complicate it, because race and class conflate it in some instances.
That was Kwame Kwayarma, Center Stage's artistic director and writer of Beneath This Place. We have to take a very brief break, but don't go away. We'll continue our conversation with Kwame when we return and hear from a very special actor, Jessica Frances Dukes, who's the actress who plays Francine, Lena, and Benitha in the performance we've been talking about.
WEAA is in need. We need to raise an additional $25,000 before June 30th in order to hit our end of the fiscal year goal, to continue to provide the great music and intelligent talk you love. If you're able to help us hit our end of the fiscal year goal with any level of support, then pledge right now securely online at WEAA.org or call 443-885-2075. Support this program. Make a difference, and thank you. Jazz, a Bronx original restaurant, offering Bronx-style pizza and homemade Italian-American dishes, located at 1415 Alice Anna Street in Baltimore. Information at jazzbronxoriginal.com or 410-522-5511.
It's time for a celebration. This is your formal invitation to the 24-hour Strictly Anniversary broadcast. Your favorite DJs will be mixing, honoring legends in hip-hop, starting at 12 a.m. this Friday on WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. And listen for your chance to win tickets to see LL Cool J and Ice Cube at the Kings of the Mic Tour at the Lyric on Wednesday, June 12th. Strictly hip-hop.
Want to start your weekend off the right way? Then enter the journey every week with the Friday Night Jazz Club. Part one with the Duchess. Relaxed, calm, soothing, rhythmic, hot, soulful, sexy, and vibing. It's the Friday Night Jazz Club every Friday at 8 p.m. till midnight. Guaranteed to set your mood just right.
Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner. We're going to continue our conversation with Center Stage's artistic director, Kwame Kwayarma, about the Raisin Cycle plays, a double-header performance now at Center Stage that explores the world where A Raisin in the Sun by Lorraine Hansberry left off.
I love the connections you kept strong in that, between the first and the second act around oil and Nigeria and all the contradictions inside of that.
It was important for me because in a way, we look at a lot of the things that are happening in the world today, and we don't necessarily root them back to things that happened at the genesis of these new countries when they were being made independent, about divisions that were made, about deals that were made around the natural resources. And all of this can sound very heavy, but actually, I've tried in the play to approach this stuff with a sense of humor, with a sense of irony, with a sense of, if you know, ever was it thus? You know, the human nature, no matter where it finds itself, contorts to fit it and sometimes even corrupts its environment in order to serve itself.
I mean, I think it's important to our listeners who have not yet seen this cycle that there's a lot of humor in these two plays.
Personally, the kind of theater that I like is the kind of theater that gives you everything in the night, you know, that can take you from laughter to possibly tears, but certainly emotion and without doubt empathy for every single person on the stage, be they good or be they bad. And I think that the Raisin cycle, Bruce, you know, throws that gauntlet down because Cliveborn is hilariously funny. It's funny because it's outrageous as well. And so it behooved me to attempt to layer a level of humor into Benita that allowed us access, not just through the mind, but through the gut.
In the handout that you're given when you walk through the stage doors,
yes,
one of the folks, you have a number of interesting people writing in this. One of them, Dr. Phaedra Chedard Carpenter from University
yes.
of Maryland. And talks about property, privilege, and place.
Yes.
And that is a big piece of this, too, in both places.
It's at the core of all of them. In Raisin in the Sun, it is a cry for the African-American community to be able to partake in the American dream, to be able to start a business, property, and then to be able to own a slice of the good life, as in buying the house. It is about property and ownership. In Cliveborn, it is about the house being sold and the neighborhood possibly being invaded, quote, unquote, by African-Americans. It's about territory and ownership. And in Benita's place, it's set in Nigeria, where the Nigerians are saying to the British, this is our territory, we own it. And actually the new colonizers, quote, unquote, are now saying, yes, you may do that, and that's fine, but we will own the resources that allow the country to survive. And in the second act, but we will be the people who define what African-American history is, really is, and not you. So the whole play, all three of them are about ownership, are about privilege. And I think that privilege is something that we don't speak about enough, about the innate bonuses and the innate castles that we stand upon because of the world that we're born into. I often describe my own privilege as someone who has benefited from the transatlantic slave trade. I've benefited because even though it was the blood of my ancestors, I was born in a first world country that allowed me to have many of the benefits that my fellow people and my fellow folk in the motherland, in Nigeria or Ghana or Africa or even in the Caribbean, have not been. And what is my responsibility? Well, then I have a responsibility if I recognize that I've been born with privileges. I have a responsibility if I can see those privileges to assist in making the world fairer. So right at the core of all of these plays and right at the core of putting this cycle together was to pose questions about equality, access, and privilege.
And you can't live in a principle, can you?
That's part of the complication of life is that we all stand, don't we? And we all stand for things, and we all believe and chant on behalf of many things, you know, to make the world a better place. And then, without even knowing it, and complicit with exploiting others. I often describe, you know, when we think about, for instance, slavery, and we think about discrimination in the 20th century. That in the 21st and 22nd, they'll look upon us and our attitude to inequality, our attitude to walking past people who are sleeping on the street while we work out how we get our coffee shots. I think they will judge us almost as harshly as we judge those from a previous time, because it's outrageous that there are so many of us that have so much, but yet so many who have very little. And I think the nakedness of that
yeah.
will, we'll be judged for it.
One of the things I thought about, though, in watching your play, Beneath His Plays, I tell you, Kwame, both of us were sitting there, Valerie and I, were just blown away at the end.
Bless you.
Because I think that it took somebody like you to do this. This is what I mean by that. You see the raisin in the sun, raised issues for America that really, in many ways, only a black person, a black woman of that era could raise, to throw out and say this is what exists. Someone, as she was, very much in love with the home country, very in love with her blackness in the 50s, very much in love with kind of, she was a civil rights worker and she kind of didn't trust liberals and she wasn't quite sure she could be a nationalist and she was in the midst of the entire struggle, right?
Correct. She critiqued everything.
Everything.
She critiqued everything, but understood it and ran with it.
And Claiborne Park was kind of, Claiborne Park, also was a great play. I especially enjoyed the first act. I like the whole play, but the first act I think was really strong.
Yes, I think so too.
But it was like a white response to it. It was a white response to what their own fears about race is about in many ways. And I think it took somebody like you to kind of bring it back home, to kind of say these are the complexities that you're not seeing. You have to look in this mirror to see these complexities to make it work. I mean, it was just so important. I think I didn't know what you were going to come up with, Kwame, when I knew you were wrestling with this. I had no idea. And it's just.
I mean, I'm not going to lie, Mark. I won't lie. And thank you for your kind words. You know, in some ways, is the most important play of my career, because I had placed myself up against the firing squad. I was standing against the wall.
Yes, you were.
And had armed, and I, you know, my executors, and you know, by putting myself in the ring with two giants, Raisin in the Sun and Claiborne Park. And Claiborne Park is the most beloved play of the last 5 years,
correct,
I would say. And you know, and Tony and Pulitzer Prize winning, and I often perceived that there was no way I could come out of it clean. I felt this in my heart. I felt, if not me, who, if not now, when? When I saw so little response about Claiborne and about it saying, this is actually a play, this is a white reply, and saying we are frustrated, and that would be the inheritor of Lorraine Hansberry's Raisin in the Sun, and troubled me a little bit, only because of the lack of criticism about some of the assumptions in it. So, you know, I went after the opening night performance and it was received so well, you know, I, for the next 3 days, I simply just gave thanks to the Almighty for saving my life in many respects. You know, I was walking around probably singing Amazing Grace. that one had managed with not just me, but with a great team of actors and director and team that we had managed to avoid me being shot against the wall. But even if I had been, and you've heard me say this before, you know, I could look at my children in the eye and say, I saw something, it troubled me as a man of color, and I felt that art is my only weapon. I'm not a politician. I'm not a rock star that can gather people around an issue and then drive it home. I'm a playwright, and if art is my weapon, then I must make sure that I do what my soul requires, and it required a response. And so, hence, we put the cycle together. So Mark, I'm tremendously relieved, actually, just that so many people have taken so much from Benita. It's touched me profoundly.
I hope it's seen beyond here, and it will be, I'm sure. We have to talk a bit about the art itself and the actors in this play. I mean,
my God!
The people cast here are stunning actors to a person.
I've got to tell you, Mark. I've got to tell you. You know, after there are two times when a playwright is really nervous. The first is when you first hand in the play for an artistic director to read, and the second is when you're casting. Because if you don't get the right actors, the play dies. Well, we slam dunked on the actors. The director, Derek Saunders, was wonderful in the audition process of seeking out actors who could not just play one character well, but four. Two in Clybourne,
right.
Two in Benita. And he did a magnificent job in leading a team through what was a little bit of a media circus. We had PBS shooting the documentary about the Raven cycle happening. We had the BBC coming in to do interviews about it. We had, you know, the New York Times photographers. And, oh, I mean, it was just almost like a media circus. And Derek was steadfast in leading this company of magnificent actors so that they would feel comfortable in their process and that they would be able to deliver stunning work. And, you know, I'm a firm believer that at the end of the day, the playwright is to blame for everything that doesn't work, but everything that does work, it goes to the hands of the actors.
Well, this has been an amazing play. Both of them are really amazing. The acting, the directing, the writing. I'm going to encourage everyone, please, through June 16th is when it runs. You've got to go to Center Stage and see this while it's still there. And we are now going to stay tuned to continue our conversation about the Raisin Cycle with one of the actors in the Raisin Cycle who just did the most amazing job in her three roles, Jessica Frances Dukes. Stay with us for that. And Kwame Kwe Arma, thank you so much for both writing this play and getting this stuff on Center Stage. And it's always wonderful to talk to you.
Bless you, sir.
Thank you. Now we are joined by Jessica Frances Dukes, the actor who plays Francine, Lena, and Benita in The Raisin Cycle, now at Center Stage. So we were talking about this play. I know Kwame likes to do this sometimes, but he does things. He likes to throw things out there for people to do these multi-role, multi-play things, and these sometimes don't work. And he'll go, it backfired, we can't do it. But in this one, it worked. You've got two back-to-back plays, and each actor is in each play, and each actor is in the scenes of both plays. They're all two-scene plays, so you play four characters.
Yes.
Over a two-day period.
Yes. Yes, one of us plays three in one show, so it's a jumble of characters. And even though I play one character in Beneath This Place, I consider her two different characters because of the changeover.
Right. Separated by, what is it, 40 years?
Yeah.
So what is that like for an actor to do that? I mean, for you, I mean, to have to hit these different roles, you're different ages, different time and place, different pieces of history.
Well, I absolutely love it because I feel like the cycle is four different one acts. Because Clybourne Park is written the way it is, and you have it's two different plays, you know, and then Beneath This Place, in my opinion, is two different plays. So I really have to approach it as four completely different stories, and I have one person that fits into each story, and I have to, you know, really study how that person fits into the story and what part of the journey we're on and what they're meant to, you know, teach the audience in that specific part of the journey. So it's actually a lot of fun to differentiate these four women.
I'm curious, given the intensity of these plays over the issue of race and also the intensity of the plays between the characters, what was it like to have these conversations between actors about what you all were going to do, what these characters were saying about the issues they were raising?
Yeah. Well, Clybourne Park and Beneath This Place, you can't help but have the rehearsal room sometimes turn into the play, you know, because you do have black and white in the room having a conversation about race. And, you know, we have all, I'd say, in the last 4 months, it's been a while, 3 or 4 months, learned so much about each other. And, you know, Derek Saunders, our director, gave us a great space and freedom to have that conversation. And when Kwame was in the room, he gave us, you know, even more of that. So it was a safe place to talk about things that we wouldn't normally talk about, even as artists, you know, who it's a little bit easier for us to talk about these issues. But we were able to truly, truly learn a lot from each other through the characters and through our conversations in the room.
I mean, sometimes I think that plays can affect an actor and change an actor and move them around, right?
Big time.
Just because of what you do.
I'm from a family that is very, I'd say, diverse and eclectic in our ideas about social change, our ideas about religion, our ideas about all these things. So I think of myself as a very open-minded person, and coming into the process and dealing with my characters, I was like, wait, maybe I have moments where I'm not. And, you know, I've learned so much, especially through Beneath This Place. Of course, you learn through Clybourne, but being Benita and having to give space to both sides of the argument, critical whiteness studies and African-American studies, you know, it I learned a lot. Critical whiteness studies, it was a foreign topic to me before this
play. I mean, most people don't even know it exists.
Yeah.
But it does exist.
Yeah, it does. And I remember thinking, like, oh, that, what is that? I don't know what that is. I was like, come on. And then, you know, after researching it, because I have to, I was like, oh, wow, it makes sense. Well, I don't know how I feel. I'm a little confused. So, you know, it's great. It makes you, it turns you on your side. I love it.
I love what he created in that space and how Beneatha sets everybody up and does her thing, the older Beneatha.
Mm-hmm.
Clearly, when you play Beneatha, who is the daughter in Raisin and the Sun, who is in love with her Africanness and her African men, and sometimes her bougie men, but,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
Live in the South Side of Chicago. So I'm curious how you approach the idea of creating a Beneatha post Raisin the Sun. Could have fallen over an African and gotten to be an old woman.
Mm.
You went through both stages.
Yes. I got a chance to play do a Raisin in the Sun.
I saw you
ago.
Did that. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
And you played?
I played Beneatha.
Beneatha, right?
Mm-hmm.
Right.
And this time, working with Derek, the director, and, you know, really hitting the ideas of those 4 years in between A Raisin in the Sun and Beneatha's Place, what has happened. And I think that she's grown up a lot. And being a diplomat's wife, there's a lot of things, you know, our mouthy love that we have for Beneatha in A Raisin in the Sun. She can't do that in Nigeria. You know, there's a lot of things that she has to learn. And I think Asuka is truly teaching her throughout all of Act One.
Who's her Nigerian husband.
Yes.
Right.
And then she gets a chance to turn it around and teach it in Act Two. So it's just, it's an absolute joy. It's hard to even express the amount of work that we put in.
No, I can imagine.
To, you know, figure out what the journey was.
And many actors don't get to do what you did. You get to play in Raising the Sun in another theater,
mm-hmm.
and create Beneatha in Beneatha's Place,
mm-hmm.
as a woman a little older, and then play Beneatha as, I guess, a 60, 70-year-old woman,
mm-hmm.
who has now become one of the world's leading scholars.
Yes. You know, I studied a lot of women that we know, Maya Angelou, Toni Morrison, Angela Davis,
right.
and studied them.
They all come to mind watching you on stage.
Oh, thank you, because it's, you know, I watched their speeches and I watched who they were in the 70s and who they were when they were, you know, right out the gates with the radical ideas and who they are now in academia and how they teach today. And it's so different. And listening to their interviews of their transition and their progression as they've gone on, and it's just, you know, I had to think about every single experience that she's been through with, you know, what happens to Asagai and then coming back to America. And literally right when she comes back to America, you have Megger Evers, then Malcolm X, then Martin Luther King, and all these disappointments that just go along the way. But as, along with those disappointments, there's so much forward and upward movement along with that. So I try to just implement that in the 70-year-old Beneatha, all of those experiences.
Does Beneatha stay in Nigeria for 10 years before she leaves, or she's just there for a period?
No, she leaves immediately after. I think she leaves about a couple days after. She doesn't stay because it gets really dangerous there. And the best thing is to get her out of there. And I think that Asagai's family is very focused on getting her home after everything happens.
And the other play, you play a woman who is a domestic in the home of the family that actually sold the house to the Youngers who move in. That's the scene. And in that, Charlie Hudson plays your husband. Mm-hmm. And then you have to play in the second act, which is takes place in this age, not 1959, a woman who's kind of, I want for a better term, a buppy. Right?
Very much so.
A buppy. So how's that transition? Tell me how you did those two things.
Well, you know, we kind of, Derek and I, looked at all of the women in the cycle and said, who is what? You know, what role is what? And Francine, you know, this is before Black Power or any sort of, you know, uprising of
Francine's a domestic in the first scene.
Exactly. And so there was moments where, you know, I would make certain expressions or feel a certain way about something, and he would go, mm-mm, this is normal. And I had to realize that, you know, what is happening in that household and what she's surrounded by is absolutely normal. Coming from the South, which Francine is from the South, she's actually probably seen worse in 1950s.
Absolutely.
You know,
this is 1959 we're talking about,
yeah.
Right? Chicago.
Yeah, and she's already in her, you know, mid-30s, so she's seen a lot. So this is actually, it's okay. And that took a long time to kind of put in my body to realize that this is okay. This is actually, they're inviting me into a conversation. I might not like what's being said, but it's fine. Act two is a whole different story, though. I think that Lena is one of these women that is just heavy on in her community and one of the leaders in her community and speaks for her community. But it's that idea of ownership and who owns what and who deserves what. And if we've worked this hard to make this community ours now, which, in the first act, you were making it very clear that it wasn't ours.
Right.
Now it is. And you're going to come in and change everything. And it's going to affect those people that have been there since 1950s. And, because gentrification has done that a lot. Now, granted, there's some things that there's some ways that Lena goes about doing what she's doing that could be a little...
Right.
She could handle it with a little more tact. But, I love the difference between them.
I'm curious about you now. Where'd you grow up?
I grew up in Riverdale, Maryland.
You grew up here?
I sure did.
Prince George's County.
Prince George's County. Went to Parkdale High School. I'm a home girl.
Hello.
I sure did.
So did you go to high school, like at the School for the Arts in D.C.?
No, I didn't. I went to Parkdale High School. I was a part of a team performing arts troupe called Colors.
Uh-huh.
This man, Jason Cook, he basically took kids from all around the county and was just like, okay, let's do some drama. We didn't have to audition. Uh-huh. We didn't have to know how to act or sing or dance. And by the end of the program, I joined in seventh grade, and I was teaching there in college and teaching while I was in grad school. And it just, I went to Frostburg State University for undergrad and went to Catholic University for grad. So
wow.
I haven't.
And theater at Catholic U?
Mm-hmm.
They still have a good school there.
Sure do. I actually won a playwriting contest at Center Stage when I was in high school. So it's kind of full circle.
Cool. That's wild, John. Here you are.
So
when did you know this is what you had to do?
I knew that I always loved to act since I was a little girl. I knew I wanted to do it professionally the minute I stepped in front of my first big audience. And I went to see a show at Ford's Theater, and it was Anna Deavere Smith, Fires in the Mirror.
Oh, yes. Yeah. I saw that there.
Yep.
Amazing.
And I was at the same performance that Bill Clinton was at.
Uh-huh.
And I talked to her afterwards. I got a chance to meet her. And I said, do you get paid for this? And she was like, lots of money. Now, she lied, but immediately I was like, okay. And I was about a junior, and I knew I wanted to major in it in college. And then in college, once I graduated, I was like, wait, I'm not ready. I don't have Shakespeare. I need to go to grad school. And I just knew it. I knew I wanted to do this, and I have never doubted it since.
Anna Deavere Smith is another Baltimore person.
Oh, yeah.
She went to Western High School, grew mm-hmm. up here in the city.
Yep, and I love her. So,
when you auditioned for this, it's interesting. Everybody in this production is new. Heather Jackson's in the room. Heather Jackson is...
I'm the public relations manager.
There you go. And as always, arranges these things for us and does an incredible job. But so you're saying not all the actors are...
We have
one
returning actor, Jacob Knoll,
who
is in Clybourne Park. We had one additional actor in each show. The other six overlap completely. Jacob's returning. He was with us a couple of years ago for Tis Pity. But I believe everybody else is new to Center Stage. It's been a great group to welcome in.
So you're out of New York when you work?
Yes.
Why is everybody out of New York?
From here on out.
Everybody is out of New York.
This is my first time. I just moved this season. I've been in D.C. for years. I've had a great run in D.C., but I would really, truly want to expand my horizons now. So I'm going to try out some New York City time.
You ought to. I'm just teasing. Every actor has to try out New York.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm excited about it. And I'm born and raised here, so I can always, step in and step out.
Well, it's been amazing. This play is amazing. As I said at the top of the hour, this is really not to be missed for numerous reasons. The actors in this production, when I walked out of Clybourne Park the first night, then walked out of Beneath This Place the second night, I saw them back to back. I walked out of Clybourne Park, and I was just, my God. I was just blown away, shitty by the acting. The acting was amazing. It was stunning. Everybody was just... incredible. This is not a weak person in this cast.
Mm-mm.
And the same with Beneath This Place. And Kwame and I have a love affair anyway, as friends. And it's just, but
who
just,
doesn't with Kwame?
But I just said this particular work was just mind-blowing. I remember watching him go through the process of writing it and what he went through to write this piece. And just so it's just an amazing. I think people need to not miss this at all, and I remind you once again, I just cannot recommend this more. The end of the season at Center Stage. So this runs through June the 16th, Clybourne Park, and Beneath This Place, back to back, different nights with different plays, right? Tell us what to do to get to this play.
They can just visit centerstage.org or call the box office directly at 410-332-0033. Like you said, the shows alternate every other night or every third night, so they can check the website for an exact calendar. And then most Saturdays and Sundays, there's the option to see both shows in the same day, including this coming Saturday. They can actually stay after one show and watch the set be changed over with our production crew between the two productions.
That I got to see. I got to see that to see how different it is when you do that. Mm-hmm. That I got to see. I might have to come back. Just for that. I got to bring my kids anyways. I got to see it anyway. So, Jessica Frances Dukes, it was a pleasure meeting you. You're a wonderful actor. Love you and
being. Thank you so much.
Good to have you in the studio. Heather Jackson, always love you to see you.
Thanks, Mark.
Thank you also to Kwame Kwe Arma, Center Stage's artistic director and the writer of Beneath This Place, who joined us during this segment. You can see The Race and Cycle for yourself, and you need to. Do not miss this production. It includes performances of Beneath This Place and Clyburn Park from now until June 16th at Center Stage. For more information on the plays and how to get your tickets, please visit centerstage.org. And for Public Radio WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community, stay tuned now for Tell Me More and Michelle Martin. I'm Mark Steiner. Take care. The Mark Steiner Show is a production of the Center for Emerging Media. Our producers are Bobby Marvin Holmes, Stephanie Mavronis, and Mark Gunnery. Our theme music is by Wal Matthews of Clean Cuts. For WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community, I'm Mark Steiner. Take care. The Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union. Offering a full range of financial services, MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, is helping its members and its community prosper. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. For more information, www.mecu.com.